Okay, our third case is number 20-14091, Aaron Coleman versus John Ricardo et al. So, Ms. Richardson.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning.
May it please the court, my name is Ursula Richardson. I'm an assistant city attorney with the city of Tampa. And I have the pleasure this morning of representing the police officers in this case, which is Officer Gady, Officer Valentine.
Counsel, I'm sorry, you're gonna have to speak up or move the microphone closer or both. I can't hear you.
Okay, is that better, Your Honor?
Much, thank you.
Okay, thank you. But I have the pleasure of representing the four police officers who were sued in this lawsuit. As I was looking back over the briefing in this case, this is exclusively an issue of whether or not the officers were entitled to qualified immunity under Florida statute 768.28 subsection 9.
Stop you for a minute just to make sure we got the terminology right, because when I started reading your brief, I thought it was one sort of case. And then when I finished reading your brief, I thought, no, it's a different sort of case. This is only an appeal from the denial of sovereign immunity under state law on the state law claims, right?
No. Sovereign immunity exclusively belongs to the government entity, and in this particular case, the city of Tampa was not sued for any state torts. Only the police officers were sued in the complaint for state torts. So sovereign immunity is not the issue because that belongs to the government, not to the employees.
Okay, let's take the word sovereign out. This is immunity under state law for the state law claims.
Correct, for the individual police officers.
But not qualified immunity on the federal claims?
No. There were no federal claims against these police officers in the complaint.
This is not a case involving federal qualified immunity principles. This is just a case about, these are state law claims, which were supplemental, and now we have to figure out whether or not the officers are entitled to immunity under state law for the state law claims, right?
Yes.
Okay, and then the last terminology thing. Florida law, as I understand it, doesn't call that a qualified immunity the way federal law does in the analog, right? It's a statutory immunity. It's not qualified. In other words, you don't have to show the sort of things you show to get qualified immunity under federal law. You have to show the violation of a right. You've got to show that the right was clearly established, so forth and so on. Those are not the standards under state law, right?
They're not the same standards, but it's qualified to the extent that the employee is covered. The law says it should be the employer and not the employee that you sue unless the person has acted, which is a qualification. So maybe the terminology is incorrect.
No, I'm not saying what you have to look at, it's but wrong. I just don't want to get confused. Let's take the word qualified out of it.
Okay.
This is just immunity under state law, under a state statute for the state law claims, right?
Correct.
Okay, got it.
Correct. And in this instance, and what I was looking at when I look back over the case law is, number one, this case is a lot more complex in the sense that there are three agencies involved. The original animal cruelty case evolved under the Hillsborough County Animal Services jurisdiction as far as that investigation. Then there would be the separate issue of what happened on the day of the search warrant and whether or not Mr. Coleman obstructed the officer's commands on that particular day. And then there's a third issue of whether or not the Florida Fish and Wildlife had sufficient probable cause for the issue of him having possession of a snake. But what's unclear in Florida law, because it hasn't been analyzed the way that federal qualified immunity is, but I believe that this would be an instance where it would be perfect to set out some standard that's not yet been set out, which is to look at, first of all, whether or not step one, if there were a step one, this would be my proposal, a step one to look at whether or not the state tort, the elements of the state tort have been met first, and then secondary to whether or not the elements of the state tort have been met, look at whether or not the facts have risen to the level where you could then say that the officers have acted with bad faith, which means maliciously, subjective intent, malicious purpose, or with willful and wanton disregard or reckless disregard for someone's right, safety, or property.
Can I ask you just a quick question about the statutory language? Are bad faith and malicious purpose, are those kind of the same? They seem to like define themselves by reference to one another almost. Is it just kind of repetitive?
It is in some sense repetitive, except for the case, the Florida case law has specifically set out that in those instances where we're talking about the immunity itself, we're really talking about the subjective intent of the employee at the time that the thing is happening, which requires them to have some malice, evil intent, or something like that. But they are synonymous.
Yeah, with respect to either of those first two prongs, you're looking at subjective motivation intent.
Something of the individual employee
at
who's
the time.
Correct.
Okay, good.
And so in this particular instance, although it may not have been as clear as it should have been in my briefing, the first issue is whether or not you have even proven the elements of a state false arrest claim.
Sure about that. And the reason is that the Florida, the only reason we have jurisdiction here, our case law used to be that we did not have jurisdiction to take up an interlocutory appeal of the denial of state qualified immunity because we thought that under Florida law, immunity was just immunity from liability and not immunity from trial. The Florida Supreme Court has recently told us we got that wrong. So I think we have jurisdiction. But if we're guided by what the Florida Supreme Court says, it has also told us in those same opinions that liability is different than immunity. And you only do liability separately. So I don't see how we're supposed to do a merits analysis of the plaintiff's entire claim on an immunity appeal that's interlocutory in nature. I thought the issue is just, listen, taking what they've either alleged, if it's a motion to dismiss stage, or put up at summary judgment, is there an allegation, you know, at step one, or an issue of fact on step two about whether or not these officers acted with malicious purpose, bad faith, ill will, et cetera, et cetera?
Even if you don't take my proposal that you could, you know, do a step analysis, if you went kind of like under qualified immunity, if you went directly to the second, you know, the clearly established prong under Florida law, it would be that bad faith, malicious purpose prong.
So those are not the same.
I know that they're.
That's why I wanted to ask you at the beginning, because those things are not the same. So for example, on the federal qualified immunity side, and Judge Carnes and Judge Newsom can correct me if I'm wrong, you don't look at subjective intent. You look at the actions of an objective, reasonable officer under the circumstances. And subjective intent is not an issue for qualified immunity on the federal side.
Okay.
Here, it definitely is with regard to some of the exceptions. Am I mistaken?
No, you're not. And actually,
That's why the brief at the beginning, I think I understood it at the end, but at the beginning, the brief confused me because I think you were conflating those two concepts, and I don't think they can be, given the way that Florida law travels.
And that's why I said I when I look back at the briefing, I understood where some confusion may lie, and so I'll exclusively focus my attention just on bad faith, malicious purpose, and with willful and wanton recklessness. The district court went through at least 30 pages of essentially setting out how the plaintiff has successfully shown that the animal services officer set in motion a set of facts that in essence deceived the judge who issued the search warrant and also deceived her colleagues who had to assist with that and also deceived the Tampa Police Department who was called in, not that they volunteered, but that they were called to assist with the execution of that search warrant. And that all of that information that she would have been keeping to herself or those false claims, the question now becomes, if the officers were acting because they've been called there to execute the search warrant, this animal services officer has now said that these people, there are pending charges. And this is not just the officer's hearsay. This is the animal services officer giving a sworn statement to a different Tampa police officer, but a Tampa police officer nonetheless, giving a sworn statement about the facts to support why these people should be arrested. Have the officers done anything in bad faith, malicious purpose, or with willful and wanton recklessness if Mr. Coleman then gets arrested? Again, I think the issues are a little bit confusing here, again, because there's Animal Services that has given a sworn statement. We've now written, we meaning the agency, not these police officers, but the agency has now written a criminal report affidavit or a probable cause affidavit based on what the Animal Services officer has told us is her set of facts based on her investigation that support the elements of animal cruelty. The officer who then wrote the criminal report affidavit correctly recites the elements of that animal cruelty under Florida law, and cites to information given by the Animal Services officer.
The allegation from the first, if I remember the record correctly, from the first animal control officer was that there was either proof or suspected proof of cruelty towards several animals. Right, not just the one that the officer had seen.
The record shows that although the complaint was only about one Rottweiler, and the officer only saw and examined one Rottweiler, and an examination is probably a little bit far, but only saw one dog, when she went to apply for the search warrant before the court, she used animals plural as if to indicate that there was more than just that one Rottweiler that was at issue in the case. And so the question becomes, and I believe the video also clearly shows that was submitted, that the officer is really, the Animal Services officer is really kind of controlling and running things, and then our officers are there more as support and auxiliary from a law enforcement standpoint. What have they done from that standpoint that shows that they acted in bad faith? I know that Mr. Coleman's position is that generally, the Tampa Police Department has some issue with him, and so that is sufficient to show impute subjective knowledge to these particular officers. But the evidence on this record is that none of these officers had ever had any contact with Mr. Coleman prior to showing up at the house on July 10th, 2014 to assist with the execution of the search warrant.
You did not file a reply brief?
I did not.
Yeah, I was hoping to have some of that discussion in the reply brief, because I think the district court made a mistake in analyzing your immunity claim. But I think there's evidence, at least alleged on the other side, which might satisfy, for some officers, maybe the standard. But there's no reply brief, so we didn't get a discussion of whether or not the plaintiff's evidence that he puts in as an alternative ground stacks up or not.
Well, the court didn't address the bad faith issues at all. It seemed to focus, and maybe, that's probably my fault.
No, it did. The court did address it. It just addressed it in a footnote. Okay. What it said is, and this is where I think it got it, again, this is only me speaking. This is where I think it got it wrong. In footnote one, it says the officers argue that they're entitled to statutory immunity pursuant to this statute. And then the court says, for purposes of immunity under this statute, malice may be inferred from the absence of probable cause. But to give your opponents a preview of what's coming, the Florida courts have been very clear that that applies to legal malice, not actual malice. And so when you're trying to show actual malice, ill will, bad faith, subjective intent, etc., you can't infer that from the absence of probable cause. So you might be able to infer what's called legal malice for like a malicious prosecution claim or something, but not actual malice. So I think, at the very least, from my perspective, this case has to go back for the court to apply the right standard and then evaluate that evidence. But we'll give you a chance to talk about it on rebuttal.
So, yes, sure.
Thank you very much, Ms. Richardson.
Thank you.
How do I pronounce your last name? McLimont or McLimont?
McLimont,
okay. Whenever you are ready.
May it please the court, my name is Jeremy McClymont, and I have the pleasure of representing the appellee in this matter, Aaron Coleman, who is now known as Attorney Life Malcolm and is also my counsel. This court should affirm the district court's order denying summary judgment because the district court properly found that the officers, the appellant officers in this case, did not have probable cause for either of the three offenses they claim to have had probable cause for when they arrested Mr. Coleman.
So to Judge Jordan's question, though, sounds to me like you might need to get beyond probable cause and engage with some evidence of malice or bad faith.
And that's my second point, is that in addition to the district court's finding that there's an absence of probable cause, the district court also found that there was sufficient evidence within the record to suggest that these officers acted with either bad faith, malicious purpose, or willful and wanton conduct.
I'm sorry, go ahead, Judge Carnes, go ahead.
Excuse me, I can't hear your argument. You need to speak up. And
you're a tall gentleman, so there's a button somewhere there on the side where you can have the podium go up, and then that'll bring the microphone closer to you.
Not much taller. But,
I mean, okay.
Is this better?
It is when you lean in.
Okay.
So could you, where do you think the district court made those conclusions about the existence, or at least factual issues about the existence of bad faith, malicious purpose, ill will, et cetera? Where in the order do you think those conclusions are?
The district court doesn't make, beyond the footnote that you've mentioned, district court saying that the inference of malice can be inferred by the lack of probable cause, the district court doesn't make any other determinations that bad faith, malicious purpose, or willful and wanton conduct exists. The district court doesn't. But my position, or our position, is that the absence of probable cause, the district court, I don't think the district court applied the incorrect law. The absence of probable cause gives rise to the inference of malice.
Of legal malice.
Right. And
actual malice. That's, I mean, I tried to do a lot of reading this week on that issue, and it seems to me that the Florida courts are pretty clear that that inference applies only to legal malice, but not actual malice necessary to overcome immunity. But maybe I'm wrong about that.
I don't think it precludes, when it gives rise to the inference of malice, I don't think it precludes actual malice as well. I think it also could give rise to the inference of actual malice. Whether or not that actual malice exists should be a question for the jury.
But the minute an officer makes a mistake about probable cause, that gets you to a jury on actual malice?
I think if you are asking, so yes, I think it does, Judge, and for the reason that this is not a determination of, you know, facts at the summary judgment phase, it's not a determination of credibility and whatnot. I think the jury has to weigh and figure out, you know, those factual issues. So
would there ever be a case that wouldn't go to a jury? Because, I mean, isn't almost necessary precondition to getting through to statutory immunity, at the very least, there's got to be an absence of probable cause. I doubt if there's probable cause that you can make an argument that there is actually ill will, bad faith, malicious intent, whatever. So, but if your position is as soon as probable cause goes sideways, we're going to a jury, what statutory immunity case would ever be resolved at summary judgment?
I think if there is probable cause, that you're not going to find a situation where the jury is, this issue is taken away.
Yeah, but so your point, I guess, is that the class of cases in which there is probable cause, but not bad faith, malicious intent, et cetera, is an empty set. There's no such thing.
Yes, I would agree. Okay. And in this case, other than what the district court cited to in her order, I still think that there is still facts sufficient to prove that these officers acted with either bad faith, malicious purpose, or willful and wanton conduct. In this case, Mr. Coleman arrived at the house, at his house, and the search warrant was being served at the time where he arrived to the house. He walks inside of the gate to his house, and the officer states to him, "This is an active investigation." Mr. Coleman responds to that officer and says, I don't hear quite well." He's hearing impaired. "I don't hear quite well. Did you say that this is an active investigation?" The officer then says, "Yes, please step outside of the gate." Mr. Coleman says, "Yes, I will step outside of the gate." And in the same moment, Officer Valentino, who is the instigating officer in this case, Officer Valentino grabs Mr. Coleman along with Officer Fair and Officer Ricardo and Officer Gady. Sorry. Officer Valentino, what should be understood about the relationship between Officer Valentino and Mr. Coleman is that 6 months prior to Officer Valentino arriving at Mr. Coleman's house, he broke his ankle chasing Mr. Coleman's son down the street from Mr. Coleman's house in the same neighborhood. Officer Gady and Officer Valentino are both partners. Officer Gady testified in his deposition that he missed his partner, Officer Valentino, when his partner was out of the police force for 3.5 months. He also testified and admitted that he was upset because his partner, Officer Valentino, broke his ankle while he was chasing Mr. Coleman's son. So 6 months prior to this officer making the arrest of Mr. Coleman, he breaks his ankle, and within a month of him getting back on the force in full duty, he's at Mr. Coleman's house. He did not follow the procedures and protocols of Tampa Police Department to even be involved in this search warrant at Mr. Coleman's residence.
I think we get the general background of how this all played out, but I would think that your strongest arguments are with regards to officers Gady and Valentino, under my reading of Florida law, because with them, it's not just the arrest without alleged probable cause. It's the use of violence when Mr. Coleman was already secured and in the police car. So as the district court explained for summary judgment purposes, when Mr. Coleman is speaking to Officer Gady in the back of the car, here's what the district court said. Then Gady then kicked Coleman's right foot twice, and Valentino placed his right foot against Coleman's left foot like you would to chalk a wheel. So I would think that at least with regards to those two officers and those actions, because those are physical force actions for someone who is detained, secured, in cuffs in the back of a car, you could make, I think, a pretty good argument that there are issues at summary judgment about actual malice. I'm not so sure about the others.
And so I was going to get to, I guess it's a sequence of events. You know, when they get to the house, why they get to the house, Officer Valentino gets to the house because as he's about to clock out of his shift, he sees on his computer screen that officers are going to serve a search warrant at Mr. Coleman's house, the same person who son caused him to break his ankle. And so instead of clocking out, he turns his car around and goes to Mr. Coleman's house to help serve a search warrant that he was not at the briefing for. He did not see the search warrant. He did not know the purpose of the search warrant, what the individuals looked like, who they were searching, or what the subject of the search warrant looked like, or what they were looking for. He had not read the notice by the animal protective investigator. He just went to the scene because he had the subjective intent to do something, to arrest Mr. Coleman for something. And within 60 seconds of him seeing Mr. Coleman, he did just that. Now, Officer Valentino, as he nods his head and makes it clear to Officer Ricardo and Officer Gady that they are going to arrest Mr. Coleman as he gets on the scene. Yes, Mr. Coleman is kicked twice by Officer Gady, knocked off balance, and as he's kicked twice, Officer Ricardo, from behind, slams Mr. Coleman into the police cruiser, the police car, bruising Mr. Coleman's sternum and his ribs. In addition to that,
counsel.
Yes, Judge.
I looked at your record citations. What you're now saying may be somewhere in the record, but it's not where you cited in your brief. But let me ask you one thing. I may have misunderstood what Judge Jordan said, or I may have read the brief literally when I shouldn't have. But the business about pushing his feet or kicking his feet apart, that occurred before he got into the car, didn't it? I mean, they arrested him and put him up against the car and then put him into the car. Did he not?
Correct. So
and let me finish. They didn't kick his right foot twice after he was in the car and secured and handcuffed, did they?
That's correct. So outside of the vehicle, Mr. Coleman's foot was his foot was chalked like a wheel by one officer, and the other kicked his leg twice to knock him off balance. And then that's when Officer Ricardo slammed him up against the police cruiser and bruising his ribs.
Now you said slammed up, but I read the record citations and I didn't see any record support for slamming him up against the car. Where was that? Whose deposition was that in?
So that is going to be at docket entry 54-3, page 213. Lines 10 through 13.
And I look there, I will see that he slammed him up against the car, injuring his ribs.
Yes, Judge. And you may not see the word slam, but push may be the word that you see there. I think that,
you know, counsel, that's exactly my problem. You cite pages of the record, and I go there, and push becomes slammed. And the injury to the ribs, I don't find yet, at least not where you cite me to. And you also cite the complaint for some of the quote facts. Those are allegations, not facts. And your client was deposed, and you can't cite at summary judgment the allegations of the complaint as evidence unless it's sworn, verified, and so forth, so on.
And in the brief,
go ahead. I'm sorry.
In the brief, there may be facts that are cited to from the complaint as it relates to the facts that I am mentioning now in oral argument. I don't believe that any of those come from the complaint in this case. So in addition to these officers pushing or slamming Mr. Coleman up against the vehicle, Mr. Coleman was eventually placed in a police cruiser. Officer Fair shows up to relieve some of these officers from duty on the scene. And at that time, he takes Mr. Coleman out of the vehicle. What he calls searches Mr. Coleman, but Mr. Coleman's version of the facts, Officer Fair forcibly squeezed and molested Mr. Coleman's genitals, not once but three different times, placed him in the vehicle.
Counsel, I didn't find that in the record citations that you pointed to at all. As a matter of fact, when you ask Farrah about that, or somebody asked Farrah about that, is there a particular reason why you were searching me? This is when the guy was, your client was pro se. You were squeezing my testicles. I don't recall that. But I will say that during a thorough search, the hand, you do put your hand up in the genital area. It's been known that people have had hidden handcuff keys, weapons, other contraband drugs. I've found drugs in people's underwear before. That is a common search technique. And then the pro se plaintiff gets back several pages later. Why is it necessary to squeeze one genitals? Answer, I don't recall ever doing that. And I was like, you know, I asked you, this is, again, your client. I asked you if you like what you were feeling. I understand it's been 5 years ago, but, you know, I'm very surprised you don't recall this at all. He said, answered by the officer Fair, deputy Fair, I recall you saying that, yes, and I recall doing a thorough search, which was no different from any other search that I've done, which does not include grabbing the genitals. So you cite for your client's questions as facts, even though the sworn testimony, the officer denies it.
The officer admits that he searched Mr. Coleman three times in that area. For what reason, I have no idea why he would be searching Mr. Coleman in the same area three times, pulling him out of a vehicle, putting him back in a vehicle, pulling him out of a vehicle, in front of his family, who was there on scene. And for Officer Fair to admit that he searched him three times with no apparent reason as to why, I think it goes towards...
Well, was he asked why?
He's in his deposition testimony, he says he doesn't remember, you know what he did.
He doesn't remember why he searched him three times?
Well, not why he searched him three times, but he doesn't remember, where he grabbed Mr. Coleman.
Now, the district...
No, my question is, you said there was no reason for him to search three times. What is your evidence he searched him three times?
I think you just read the deposition testimony by Fair, where he says that on the third search, and that would be the three times.
Now, the district court, in its order, and I haven't gone back into the record like Judge Carnes has, but the district court laying out the summary judgment evidence says this: Fair then repeatedly removed Coleman from the car to perform additional searches, squeezing his genitals forcefully enough to cause pain. And the district court has the last part of that in quotes. And the quote is to docket 69-15 and to docket 54-3. Is one of those a complaint and is one of those a deposition?
69-15 is Officer Fair's deposition. And what was this? The
other one is 154-3 at 106.
That would be Mr. Coleman's deposition.
Okay. So if that's not correct, the district court looked at that and got that wrong too, because there are specific record sites to that piece of language.
I think that is correct, that the district court properly cited to those facts.
Okay.
And I see that my time is running out. I do want to briefly conclude, and I'll yield my time.
About 30 seconds.
I think that the court here lacks jurisdiction because all we have been doing in this case is determining, you know, factual issues, whether there is probable cause or is not probable cause, whether these officers acted in with bad faith, malicious purpose, or willful and wanton conduct. The Florida Supreme Court has stated in McKee versus Volusia, that the issue of whether there's bad faith, malicious purpose, and willful and wanton conduct on the part of the officers is a question of fact. And all we have here is questions of fact. The city attorney has said that this is a confusing issue. I think maybe it could be to some people. I don't think it's confusing, but I think that this is something that a jury should be considering and not this court.
All right, thank you so much.
Thank you, Judge.
If I could, for the record, just to make sure that there are some corrections, the portion of the court's brief where she is speaking about Officer Fair, Officer Fair during his deposition said he did not have a recollection of searching Mr. Coleman three times. Mr. Coleman was searched three times. There is an indication in the police report that Officer Hill, who was Officer Fair's partner, searched Mr. Coleman at some point. There was Officer Fair who searched Mr. Coleman at some point, and obviously the initial search was by Officer Gady. Going back to the side of the car, when Mr. Coleman was handcuffed and walked over to the police car, his chest was turned towards the police car, obviously putting him in a search posture, and the chalking of the wheel and the discussion about what was happening at the police car is all in an effort to put him in the search posture so that he could be searched. He specifically says, and I believe during my deposition tried to make sure that I understood what he was saying, is that essentially the officer took his foot, the officer who was on his left side took his right foot and put the right foot on the instep of Mr. Coleman's left foot in order to move it to the left side.
Right, but that doesn't really matter, right? What matters for summary judgment purposes is how Mr. Coleman described that incident, right? If the officer says, all I did was put my foot inside his instep and sort of move it off to the side so he'd be in a position to be better subject to a search, and Mr. Coleman says, I did exactly as I was asked, and he just repeatedly kicked me in the foot. You'd take Mr. Coleman's version of that for summary judgment purposes, right?
Not in this particular instance when you're describing, because the officer's position is that in that process of trying to move Mr. Coleman's foot, Mr. Coleman kept moving it back, and they wind up, in some essence, kicking each other.
In these cases, we've all seen enough of them. And in the great, I don't think I'm exaggerating by saying that in the great majority of them, the police officer's version of events is somewhat different than the plaintiff's version of events. And when you're at summary judgment, as long as the testimony is based on personal knowledge, right, and it's not physically impossible or crazy, you take the version of the incident in the light most favorable to the non-moving party.
Well, if we accept Mr. Coleman's statement, all in essence that has happened is he said that Officer Gady, not Officer Valentino, the testimony from Mr. Coleman himself was Officer Valentino only put that one foot on the left instep and moved it over, but the struggle was on the right side where Officer Gady was. But even in that instance, we're talking about a little bit of difficulty getting him into the search position, but then once he's in the search position, Officer Gady pats him down, and nothing's found, and so then he's put in the police car. I still think you're talking about an ordinary incident of arrest, even if it didn't go completely smoothly or without incident.
You may be right about what it amounts to or doesn't. My point is you've got to take Mr. Coleman's version of events as accurate for purposes of summary judgment. Right?
Even if we take it as accurate, we're still not to that point where we're talking about clearly excessive force, such that we're now saying that the officers' efforts to get him searched and what happened during that search now arises to that officer having some evil or subjective intent, because search incident to arrest is required. It's what happens in every single arrest. And so the fact that there was some lack of cooperation on the both of their parts doesn't then equate to the officer having some subjective or evil intent. I know that we said that we're staying away from the facts so much, but in essence, the court ruled that the officers didn't have any reason to touch Mr. Coleman because they did not have probable cause. If, in fact, probable cause existed, there is some, at least some argument that whatever force was used is subsumed in that false arrest argument and is not a concrete and discrete. I mean, the kicking that's been described and the alleged injury that's been left behind is not, under this court's standards, something that would arise to something that is considered unreasonable, clearly excessive force.
All right. Thank you very much, Ms. Richardson and Mr. McLaughlin. Thank you very much as well. We'll take the case under advisement.